In this next hour, we hear People versus Pipelines, a panel discussion and an update on the Enbridge Tar Sands Pipeline expansion that is proposed to run through Wisconsin and the northeast corner of Dane County. This talk took place on June 9, 2016, on the UW-Madison campus and was sponsored by 350 Madison, the Madison Institute, WISE, and the Sierra Club. First, we hear from Molly Plunkett, a member of 350 Madison and a board member of the Madison Institute. She introduces the speakers.
350.org is an organization that was started in 2011 by Bill McKibben, who was frustrated by the lock that the fossil fuel industry exercised over Congress. And in 2011, Bill McKibben issued what's now his famous call for climate activists to start a new grassroots uprising by coming to Washington to sit down and get arrested in front of the White House opposing the Keystone XL pipeline. There were 19 people from Madison who answered that call, and when they returned to town, those 19 decided to form a local chapter of 350, which has grown to have a mailing list of over 800 people to continue to carry Bill McKibben's message to central Wisconsin. Keystone has now been replaced by another Canadian company, Enbridge, which has a pipeline expansion plan through Wisconsin, including the northeast corner of Dane County. 350 Madison is now front and central, along with the Minnesota 350 chapter, in a fight to keep fossil fuels in the ground. This panel is an update to a panel that we sponsored in fall of 2014. The panelists tonight include, in the order that they'll be speaking, Cassie Steiner, who is an employee with the Wisconsin chapter of the Sierra Club, the John Muir chapter. She is a recent graduate of UW-Whitewater who studied international studies, public diplomacy, Spanish, and social justice. While she always planned to work in the social justice realm, the environmental movement pulled her in when she found out that a tar sands pipeline less than 3 miles from her college campus was being expanded and would soon become one of the largest tar sands pipelines in the world. She has since jumped into climate change movement and utilizes her background in communications and student organizing to strengthen the regional climate justice movement. Mary Beth Elliott is an emerita professor as of 2013 from UW-Madison School of Pharmacy. She received a bachelor's degree with honors in biochemistry from Harvard, a PhD in pharmacology from UW-Madison, working with Dr. Theodore Goodfriend, and a doctor of pharmacy from UW-Madison. In 2014, Mary Beth joined Sierra Club and 350 Madison, where she is the tar sands leader. Mary Beth is interested in the risks of tar sands spilling to animal and human health. Next is Ronnie Monroe, who actually lives just east of Lake Mills. She formerly lived right on the pipeline, that was during the 80s and 90s, before she even knew it was an oil pipeline. Her background is in community health nursing. She's a mom and a grandmother. She's also been a medical first responder. Her concern is for the safety of the people on or near the pipeline. She founded Brave Wisconsin in 2014, shortly after speaking at the Jefferson County Board in favor of an EIS. She is a founding member of the WISE Alliance as well. Last is Harry Bennett, retiring organic grain trader and a full-time grandpa. In 2008, Harry fought the Keystone Cushing Extension Pipeline next to his farm in Kansas. And then in 2011, he moved to Madison, and he's still at it. So Cassie will be starting off with the presentation.
I'll be talking mostly about youth involvement in the movement because I think that's a piece that sometimes gets left out in the story that we talk about, but it's so important. But before I get into that, I do want to provide some background information on the pipeline system and tar sands in general. So the map displayed up here is a map of the United States and the pipeline systems that go through North America. The line goes through Wisconsin, and that's the Enbridge main line coming from Alberta. Tar sands, as many of you know, is a really thick, heavy, dirty oil. Enbridge will call it heavy crude oil to try and make it sound like conventional crude oil. But it's a little bit different than that. It's incredibly thick and it's incredibly inefficient. This means it needs to be diluted with chemicals. It needs to be sold at a discount compared to conventional crude oil. It will yield less gasoline and more diesel fuels. And the sludgiest thick end product can actually be used as a coal substitute, and it burns even dirtier than coal. So that really sludgy end substance is almost pure carbon, which means it releases 5 to 10% more carbon when burned than even coal does. The Alberta tar sands are the tar sands that flow through the Enbridge system that goes through Wisconsin and most of our nation. It's one of the world's largest deposits of tar sands, and it's located under the boreal forest, which is in northern Alberta off the shores of the Athabasca River. And the tar sands area in Canada is around the size of Florida. So just to give you an idea of how huge this area is, that's the kind of magnitude we're talking about, an entire state. So beyond concerns about spills and concerns about the climate, which some of the folks up here might talk about, there's also a huge concern about lack of habitat through this process. So this beautiful forest, which is home for caribou and wolves and bird species, including migratory and endangered birds, is at risk, and it's turned into a moon landscape. It's quite a stark contrast to that lush green forest. Tar sands, unlike conventional crude oil, require open pit mining. So you don't drill an oil rig, you strip mine, and that requires the forest to be clear cut and excavated. 4 tons of earth have to be removed for 1 barrel of bitumen oil. 2 to 4 barrels of water is used for each of those barrels of oil, and the extraction process is 3 to 5 times more carbon intensive than conventional crude oil drilling. So we're talking about a pretty dirty process. And recently, to get this oil out of the ground, you have to have a lot of heat, which has meant that they are building nuclear power plants to heat the land to get the oil out, which is insane. There's a lot of water waste that goes into this project. To get that thick oil through pipes, you have to use a lot of chemicals and a lot of water. And when that water mixes with oil and chemicals, it doesn't really do much good for people. It's pretty heavily polluted. And it's stored in these tailings ponds, which cover 70 square miles up in the Alberta tar sands. I have a friend who's traveled up there and has seen this firsthand. And I had mentioned those migratory birds. Well, they fly over the tailings ponds, and if you're a bird and you're flying over 70 square miles of water, you probably want to land there, right? I mean, you probably want that water. And if it's polluted with chemicals and oil, it's unsafe, and it can kill off those birds and other animals in the region. And so to try and stop this, the companies that work up there have noise cannons that go off. And my friend who has been up there talks about this sounding like a war zone. You have to listen to cannon fire that's scaring away these birds with huge orange scarecrows on the tailings ponds. And he said it looks like a zombie army, which is not something that you should see in real life. And this is what's happening up there. Through the heart of Wisconsin, the Line 61 corridor is home to the second largest tar sands pipeline in the world, second only to a tar sands pipeline in Russia. It currently carries somewhere around 560,000 barrels per day, and it's in the process of expanding to 1.2 million barrels per day, which makes it larger than the rejected Keystone XL pipeline that President Obama rejected on climate grounds. Why was this allowed to expand when Keystone was rejected? In that corridor, though, there's not just Line 61. There are actually 4 pipelines. Line 14 carries a light and medium crude oil, according to Enbridge. We're not sure if that means tar sands or not. Line 6A, which carries tar sands, and then Line 13, which carries chemical diluent back north so that that chemical can be used again to send more south, more oil south. So that's what's running through our state. It's not just the tar sands oil, but it's also these volatile chemicals that Mary Beth will talk more about in a couple minutes. As if these four lines were not enough, Enbridge seems to be moving forward with a twin line to the Line 61 pipeline, which would give us the two largest tar sands pipelines, except for the one in Russia, next to each other running through our state. It would require an additional easement, and it would twin our risk of a spill, and it would further damage our climate. Unless all of us come together, right? Farmers and environmentalists, retirees, students, working people, we have to come together and fight this. And the people I have sitting at this table with me are here to share stories about their parts of this fight, and why they're concerned and why they've been fighting this for years and spending so many hours of their lives doing everything they can to stop this. But the story that I'm here to talk about is representative of the young people in our state, which have really, really inspired me in the past year and a half. My peers in this fight have been incredible, and that's part of the story that I want to tell you today. So as mentioned, I went to UW-Whitewater, which is around 3 miles away from the pipeline that runs through that county, or the same pipeline, but it runs 3 miles from Whitewater's campus. I've only been out of school for just about a year, and I've only known about tar sands for about a year and a half, so that's where I've come from. When I was a student, I was really focused on human rights and social justice, and I had a friend who was the leader of an environmental group on Whitewater's campus, and he came to me and said, we have to work together, we have to do a forum about this pipeline that's expanding, it's really close to campus, and I was like, nah, I don't know if students will care about that. I don't really know what tar sands are. I don't really know what this expansion means, the pipelines in the ground. I don't really get it. And then he started telling me some of the things that I've shared with you today and some of the things that you maybe have heard in prior panels or prior events about this expansion process happening in our state. And I started to get furious, and I was like, yes, we have to do this. We have to pack that room. We need to. And so I jumped on board, and together we helped plan a forum on our campus that many people in this room came to. We packed our auditorium. Over 200 people attended that forum. There was a speaker from 350 Madison, from Sierra Club, the DNR, and Enbridge came. And I was shocked listening to my peers leave the room. With that array of speakers, you'd think that the reaction would be kind of split, right? That some maybe would be like, that Enbridge speaker had some good points. No one. As people were leaving the room, they were furious, and they were so upset that the concerns that were raised by the speakers from Sierra Club and 350 Madison, those concerns were not answered. And so my peers started to really get awake to this issue and started to organize. And little did I know that that event would be what leads the rest of my life in a totally different direction, leads me to work at Sierra Club and fight this. But little would I know that it actually revitalized the environmental fight among the youth in Wisconsin. And so since then, students have done amazing things in the past year and a half. And I don't just mean students. Of course, non-student youth are part of this as well, and even some high school students. They have held protests, street theaters, and mock oil spills, including protesting outside of the Democratic presidential debate that was in Milwaukee, and eventually verbally secured opposition from Bernie Sanders to the Enbridge expansion projects, of course, with help from friends in Minnesota influencing him as well. So he actually did come out in opposition to the Enbridge expansions. Students also participated in Break Free from Fossil Fuels Midwest. They participated around the state and around the nation in a day of action in December after the Paris climate talks. Students have put their bodies on the line, and not just students in our world or in our country, but Wisconsin students have put their bodies on the line to fight Enbridge. Last summer, at least 4 Wisconsin students were arrested on Secretary John Kerry's doorstep, protesting the Enbridge Alberta Clipper pipeline expansion at an event called Midwest Unrest, which a Wisconsin student named. 2 Wisconsin students were part of the Duluth 7 protesters that were arrested for sitting in an Enbridge office and refusing to leave. 2 Wisconsin students were recently arrested at Break Free Midwest by police clad in riot gear, and the police outnumbered protesters around 3-1. And some Wisconsin students were in that number. So they've put their bodies on the line. This is something that really matters. Students, beyond being active in protests, have also educated one another and their communities. They've tabled at community events, and one of our most active students is leading not one, but 2 sessions at the MREA Energy Fair about the Enbridge pipeline. Students have also coordinated 2 tar sands tours, one around the region in spring 2015 with the support of community members and nonprofit staffers. And then one this past spring that was just in Wisconsin. We went to 7 UW campuses in 5 days, and that was entirely youth-led and organized. Students have also worked regionally. Wisconsin students were part of the core team to plan the tar sands track of the Midwest Youth Climate Convergence in Minnesota, and over half the team of that core planning group was from Wisconsin. And currently, we have Wisconsin students that are really active in planning and recruiting students to attend Midwest Power Shift, which is a youth leadership workshop in Detroit this August. And students are getting organized, and they're getting strategic. And boy, I'll tell you, if I was Enbridge, I'd be really afraid of what these future consumers are looking like. Students are becoming really effective at campaign planning. They've been creating SMART goals that are strategic and measurable and realistic. And they've come up with timelined tactics and clearly identified decision makers to target in their campaigns, which is not something that, when I was a student, I had enough direction even to do. So to see students younger than myself do these things is really exciting. Not only are they demanding for the end of the tar sands, but they're advocating for clean energy alternatives, so they're working cradle to grave on this movement. They're contributing to research, print materials, graphics on social media, and much more. And this summer, we even have a student from Whitewater who's creating county-by-county maps that look at waterways that the pipeline crosses, community assets, and possible spill zones. Students are starting to coordinate throughout the state and have created the Wisconsin Youth Network, which we call WIN, W-I-Y-N. It currently includes all but 3 of the 4-year UW system universities, and they've established goals to connect with the 2-year schools as well. That network works on tar sands, divestment, reinvestment, and clean energy with the Sierra Student Coalition Seize the Grid campaign. All of those campaigns have an intersectional focus, looking at the social justice components of this transition as well. And so students and non-student youth are often underestimated, but we shouldn't be. I believe that the climate movement in the Midwest can gain the much needed energy to continue to fight in this really heavy political climate by building strong youth leaders who are open to cross-issue movement building and creative new ideas. I'm really thankful for a lot of the people in this room who have been really open to the young voice and who have given us the opportunity to lead, because without encouragement from many of the people who share this stage with me and a few who are in the audience, I wouldn't be here, and many of the voices in this movement would not be here. So thank you to those who are really encouraging youth leadership, and I'm hopeful that my generation won't be seen as lazy or self-obsessed or, I don't know, only looking at our phone screens, and that we won't be underestimated. Because when my generation becomes the utility ratepayer, the head of household, and the transportation decision maker, We are more than prepared to make greater demands for clean and renewable energy, sustainability, and clean and equitable transportation options that sure as heck don't include Enbridge and don't include tar sands oil.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to People vs. Pipelines, a panel discussion and an update on the Enbridge tar sands pipeline expansion that is proposed to run through Wisconsin and the northeast corner of Dane County. The speakers are Cassie Stein, Mary Beth Elliott, Ronnie Monroe, and Harry Bennett.
Mary Beth Elliott is an emerita professor. In 2014, Mary Beth joined Sierra Club and 350 Madison, where she is the tar sands leader.
Enbridge is a proud owner of more than 800 spills in North America over many years. This was from a report that was published a few years ago, and by now they're still adding more spills. There's going to be an Enbridge pipeline in Wisconsin that will carry an unprecedented 2.1 million gallons per hour of tar sands oil, 583 gallons per second, which is very scary when you break it down that way. It's scary anyway you break it down. And it has this dangerous soup of chemicals, as Cassie alluded to. The Kalamazoo spill, which occurred July 25th and 26th, because they didn't shut it down quickly, 2010, spilled almost a million gallons, and it's still not completely cleaned up, even though it cost $1.2 billion and more even. The health effects are very concerning, and we'll kind of focus on those. Enbridge does not carry insurance for environmental restoration post-spill and does not appear to have sufficient funds in-house either. So we're very concerned about the lack of deep pockets now and the lack of deep pockets down the line when they have other terrible spills. And this photo just shows you the 6-foot gash in the Kalamazoo pipe where for 17 hours tar sand spewed out with their famed control room up in Canada acting like a bunch of Keystone Cops and not really shutting it down at all properly. The cleanup problems there were, once cleanup crews locate submerged oil, it was difficult to remove without destroying the riverbed. Enbridge did not tell first responders, police, firefighters, anyone that this was different, that it was tar sands oil. It took people there on the ground to figure it out after days and days. The problem is that tar sands sink. And Steve Hamilton, who's at Michigan State, said, hey, it sticks to surfaces of plants and debris that made a tarry mess that largely had to be manually removed. And that's one of the things about tar sands. It's so devilishly difficult to clean up. It's so incredibly hard to remove submerged oil from a complex river, Dr. Hamilton said, extending over 40 miles. Interestingly also, the NRDC reported that the Kalamazoo tar sand spill cost about $29,000 a barrel to clean up. This is compared to the $2,000 a barrel for traditional crude oil. Now, moving on to kind of health effects, we've all seen these types of pictures, oil-covered birds, some of which may survive, some of which are going to die. But what about risk to people? Everybody's at risk if you're living anywhere near a tar sands pipeline. Part of the problem is that tar sands and diluents are not a natural part of the above-ground environment. It's not supposed to be up here above ground. We're supposed to keep all of that in the ground, all the tar sands, all the petroleum products, and that's one of the catchwords now, keep it in the ground. So how much health risk is posed? Well, it's not like diseases or drugs. For example, when there's a tar sand spill, there's not going to be much motivation for people to say, let's do a really good study and show what really happens to people, what happens to individuals when there's a tar sand spill, what happens to their health. With diseases, even if there aren't cures, doctors can study long-term what is considered the natural course of a disease. For example, before Parkinson's, before there was L-DOPA for Parkinson's, doctors kind of knew the course of the disease over time, sometimes slower, sometimes faster, but you'd know kind of what happens over time to people who had Parkinson's or a lot of other diseases. So that's been studied. Or drugs. We all know the FDA has phase 1, phase 2, phase 3, and post-marketing phase 4 for drugs. So you do have an idea of what is the risk versus the benefit for drugs that are put out there. That's not true for environmental disasters such as tar sand spills. And the best evidence actually is from people who get exposed. But there's not really anybody necessarily collecting that evidence and finding out what happens to people after tar sand spills. So almost no one is doing this. There's no funding for it, for example, or hardly any. And we really do need unbiased, immediate, and long-term assessment for what happens to people after a spill. Cassie mentioned the diluents, the chemicals used to dilute tar sands. These are considered proprietary, and for many years, the companies would just say, I'm sorry, that's a trade secret, we can't tell you. But in fact, when we asked, when we made a number of demands a year and a half ago of Enbridge, working with the Dane County Zoning and Land Regulation Committee, they did, in fact, fess up, and they said, okay, we'll give you the list of all the diluents and so forth. So we do have that information, and I can share with you now. The Enbridge diluents include these ingredients and several more, but I circle benzene here because this is one of the most dangerous, and this is something that really has caused a lot of concern and damage, in fact, in people at Kalamazoo, for example. The safety limit, 0.1 parts per million. You shouldn't be over that, even if you're an industrial worker. But in fact, 25 to 30% of what flows in a tar sands pipeline is the diluent. So it's not just a little bit, it's a heck of a lot of it. And in fact, for when the pipeline here, Line 61, is at full strength, it'll be 3 gallons per second of benzene alone that is flowing through that pipeline. So it's really a huge amount. Benzene is very volatile. It's very volatile, evaporates quickly. It's a carcinogen. It's a teratogen, that is to say it causes birth defects, and it has acute effects as well, as I'll share with you in just a minute. Babies are high risk, of course, if the mom is exposed to benzene or when the babies are born when they're exposed. The acute symptoms were looked at in Kalamazoo with the Kalamazoo spill. The Michigan Department of Community Health looked at 3 areas that were relatively close to where the spill was in Kalamazoo, and then they looked at one kind of control area that's shown in blue here where people were farther away, and they did reasonable controls so that they weren't just looking at old people in one group and young people in the other. So they controlled it pretty well. What they saw was that the number of people in the exposed communities who had at least one symptom was 58%, and some people even had 2, 3, and 4 symptoms. Ricky Ott, who is a Marine toxicologist who was at Exxon Valdez and BP, the BP spill in the Gulf as well as at Kalamazoo, made this great quote: "Very few people are looking at the public health implications of oil disasters. If the full human health costs of these accidents were known, it would change our energy future immediately." In the Gulf oil disaster, there are some similar side effects that people have as they did at Kalamazoo: nausea, vomiting, headache, dizziness, eye problems, coughing. And also there's accumulation of other nasty things in the environment, like heavy metals, arsenic, et cetera, and fish that people are going to be eating, and then that's bad for them, of course. For cleanup crews, it's even worse, and cleanup crews sometimes have really, really long health effects for years afterward, including psychological things, PTSD, anxiety, and depression. Dispersants are actually a pretty terrible thing. Dispersants are used like when you put detergent in a greasy pan, kind of makes it disappear, easier to clean up. Well, dispersants that oil companies use or pipeline companies use, it does kind of make it look like it visually disappears, but it doesn't actually help clean it up. In fact, BP used a lot of it in the Gulf, and it probably contributed to there being a ton left over in the Gulf, up to 35% of what was spilled is still there and still hurting animals, as well as people, I think. What about more intense and long-term exposure? People living in the industrial tar sands development zone in Alberta, and we all know about that because they had a huge fire. We've seen pictures of that area. People there with longer and greater exposure to toxins, including benzene, the heavy metals, and hydrogen sulfide, these people do have elevated rates, higher rates of blood and solid organ cancers. These have been observed pretty routinely. NRDC did a study called Tar Sands Crude Oil, Health Effects of a Dirty and Destructive Fuel, and they quoted the National Academy of Sciences, where they basically said There's very high air pollution near Fort McMurray and just outside in Alberta. And they also made the interesting point that there have been some environmental impact studies by the tar sands industry, but these systematically underestimated the pollution that was there. And that is not really a large surprise, I don't think, to many of us in this room. Some Alberta water supplies also exceed standards for chemicals linked to cancer, genetic damage, birth defects, and as well, increasing levels of methyl mercury. Many of you might be old enough to remember mercury thermometers, where, you know, the oral thermometer. Well, that mercury isn't actually all that harmful. You don't want to drink it or anything, but it's not deadly toxic. Methyl mercury is deadly toxic. Scientists have been killed in their labs from minute exposures. It's very dangerous stuff. There's also rising cancer rates in First Nation communities. In Alberta, from 1995 to 2009, increased cancer rates more than you would expect, you know, in the normal population. And an Alberta physician has said, we've got to really study the First Nations people in particular there, but there's been no independent study of cancers despite repeated calls by First Nations to say, what about our cancer risk and so forth. Treasures can be wiped out on the Gulf Coast or in the Midwest by pollution, by tar sands, by oil pipelines. This was down, I think, in Galveston. That's my kind of home territory. I'm from the Gulf Coast. And they had pictures showing what all have we lost because of the BP spill. And I think here in the Midwest, we could also put up signs saying, what are we losing or what are we likely to lose here because of Enbridge spills? An interesting quote from a cancer specialist and researcher studying cleanup crews and their families. He said, oil is not going away, and whatever kind of energy it is, whether it's nuclear, coal, or oil, all of these have had problems in recent years where people get exposed to it. But one might say, well, what about from renewables? And I'm thinking, what kind of toxicities are we going to have from renewables? Windburn? We're going to have some sunburn, maybe? It's really no comparison at all. So thank you for your attention.
You are listening to People versus Pipelines, a panel discussion and an update on the Enbridge Tar Sands Pipeline expansion that is proposed to run through Wisconsin and the northeast corner of Dane County. The speakers are Cassie Stein, Mary Beth Elliott, Ronnie Monroe, and Harry Bennett.
Next is Ronnie Monroe, who actually lives just east of Lake Mills. She formerly lived right on the pipeline. That was during the 80s and 90s, before she even knew it was an oil pipeline. She is a founding member of the WISE Alliance as well.
Despite being called so, I'm having a hard time adjusting to the label of an activist. I simply found out in 2014 that in the 80s and 90s, I lived on a tar sands pipeline. And that pipeline company back then, which was not Enbridge, did not bother to tell us. They didn't bother to tell us that the pipeline running diagonally above and next to our home had dilbit in it. They didn't bother to tell us that it contained toxic gas, which in the event of a spill would seek out low levels, such as a dip where our home was located or the finished basement where several of my kids had their bedrooms. No, they didn't bother to tell us that there could be a safety issue. Fortunately for us and for those who have come after us so far, we've been lucky. Given one KXL size line in this corridor is 50 years old, very lucky. Years went by and we moved, but we always looked upon our time west of Lake Mills fondly. That all changed after 2014 when I got an email regarding Line 61 and the request to speak at a hearing where Jefferson County was considering passing a resolution for an environmental impact statement. In one day, everything changed, and my memories became tinged. That day didn't make me an activist. It made me sad and very angry. Very angry that we were not informed about the risk. And that resulted in me speaking out against the expansion of Line 61 and now the placement of Line 66, and I guess most people call that activism. I found myself giving tours of the pipeline and learning more than I ever cared to know about valves, pipeline pigs, which are pipeline integrity gauges, and diluent. Whatever you call my response, honestly, it came from a place of self-preservation, more than some idealistic commitment, at least to start with. I hate to admit this, and it's kind of embarrassing to admit this to a room full of people who are as devoted activists as you. I live in a Norman Rockwell-like town. Its life is almost idyllic, or it was. Climate change didn't get me out on the streets, at least not then. It did get me to donate money and to belong to some organizations, but certainly not participating with the fervor of a creature defending its nest. As selfish as that seems now, there's a certain ironic poignancy to our situation, because no matter how hard we try at activism, when the activism is all said and done, whatever the result of our actions, the people in the sacrifice zone will continue to live in the sacrifice zone because our daily life, our history, our families, our legacy is here in this place we call home, this place we love, this place we are fighting for. To leave it is to leave a great deal of ourselves behind. So I'm hoping we are effective activists. So I don't think I can survive long leaving Lake Mills because it's become an industrial-sized petrochemical highway. But at the same time we fight, we sometimes find ourselves denying that this is happening at all. Yes, sometimes we forget that our home is a sacrifice zone. We forget that as we live our lives and as we marvel at the beauty around us, while our minds are piling away stacks of memories of this place called home, many of us drive over the corridor every day. And yes, even sometimes I forget, but mostly it makes me angry. I'm angry I'm driving over a tar sands pipeline and that I'm using a car that's using tar sands oil. We should be so much further along. This is not to say I'm not mortified about climate change. I am. I'm petrified for my children and my grandchildren and all the occupants of our planet. At the same time, I'm extremely concerned about my community in the here and now. And that seems to be an issue I can do something about. It's a local issue, a tidbit, more of a global issue. It's occurred to me if people don't care about their own neighbors' welfare, how can we expect our neighbors to relate to activists when we lecture them on climate change? I sometimes feel like I'm floating in a small bubble, my community inside a bigger bubble, the world, and they're both about due to pop, due to fossil fuels. We don't have much time on either issue. Working on the pipeline requires a duality that isn't comfortable for a lot of people, because at times it requires not bringing up what motivates us, climate change, and focusing more on local and what may seem less significant issues of safety and land rights. Thinking back to when I lived on the line, I may have booted myself off my doorstep had I appeared there to discuss my land and my legal entanglements with myself as they related to climate change. It's challenging work, but therein lies our greatest reward as activists. The first line of defense against this pipeline lies with the people who own the land that Enbridge wants. Instead, let's take a walk in their shoes outside of the fact that we have to fight eminent domain if they choose not to sell or defy Enbridge by speaking against this line. And they will have to at some point sit down at the table and negotiate with Enbridge, whom they just defied. Let's set aside that issue for a while and consider the day-to-day realities of living on the line. The more I learned about dilbit and its toxicity, mostly from Mary Beth, the more concerned I was about the safety of the people along the line. We have about 1,332 easement owners and likely five times more folks who have no relationship to Enbridge living in the spill zone. Enbridge defines that zone as 1,200 feet, PHMSA as 1,000 feet. If it were a natural gas line, it would be referred to as an incineration zone. Crude oil has somehow managed to avoid that label. Interesting in that crude oil, by rail, wiped out a Canadian town, Lac Megantic, wiped it totally off the map. Crude, regardless of its container, is inherently flammable and toxic. And today, I just learned that the foam used in the crude oil accident just outside of Washington, the train crash, did not work. It evaporated due to the heat. My concerns grew even more when several articles appeared in local newspapers regarding our firefighter shortage. I have no doubt they would make heroic efforts to rescue folks trapped in a spill zone. That said, their options are limited. The truth is, first responders cannot enter this kind of zone without donning their self-contained breathing apparatus. Real response time for fire and rescue can easily run into the 15 to 30 minute time frame, and that's basic rescue. If our pipeline ruptures, 2.1 million gallons of dilbit will erupt from the pipeline in various states, liquid, gas, and eventually solid, but gas is my biggest concern. Of that 2.1 million gallons, Mary Beth had just covered that 28% of it's going to be the diluent, and predominantly benzene and hydrogen sulfide among the two deadliest. It'll sink to the low spots in our geography, and this includes low-lying homes and basements. And keep in mind, it took Enbridge 17 hours to figure out they had a leak. Logistically, that probably wouldn't happen here due to the sheer volume of the spill, but the duration of an undiscovered leak depends on where in the line it happens. This is a lovely dead-end road in our area. It's had two integrity digs in the last few years. An integrity dig means there's a problem that needs fixing. The pipeline crosses the road here, which could make getting trucks and rescue personnel to those on the other side of the line very difficult. The road is in a bowl at the bottom of a hill where the pipeline curves, making a rather sharp turn at the top of the hill, just a few miles down from the new pump station in Marshall. Most ruptures of the pipeline occur downstream from a pump station where pressures are highest and also near a curve in the pipeline. Here we have both. I am sure there are many situations similar to this road in Wisconsin, but this is in my neck of the woods. Northeast Dane has some of the loveliest rural roads just like this one, and it has the same pipeline too. There was an integrity dig here last year as well. It's an upland agricultural site, so no permit was needed. We have no idea why there was a dig. Note the home to the left of the dig. This home likely won't survive the building of Line 66. I always get a bit irritated when I see the wind socks and all the rules that go up when the crews come to work on the pipelines. And I wonder, should the residents be wearing their PPE or personal protective equipment around the house? Where are the wind socks for the residents? This is the same site, only further east, in the wintertime when another dig was done. This is a wetland, so there was a permit, but we really don't know what work was done, only which pipeline was worked on. We do know it involved a daylighting machine, which sucks dirt or water away from the site. I'm not sure if it sucks oil, too. This is the only time I've seen the daylighting machine on site. The sacrifice zone stuff is still new to me, too. When residents ask Enbridge, they always tell us that our first responders are well-trained by them for any pipeline emergency. I was interested in seeing what Enbridge had to offer our first responders in terms of training, and having been a first responder myself, I signed up for and I took the 5-hour course online. I did learn a few things, but it was unimpressive. Nowhere in the course does it address a full-bore rupture of the pipeline in a residential area. I think they are on to me, though. I have not been able to log back into my Enbridge account lately. Our first responders are volunteers, and they are part of our community. They are our next-door neighbors, our friends, teachers, electricians, factory workers, farmers, and soccer coaches. Many of them work day jobs away from our town. Our fire departments are perennially short of firefighters during the day, and there are times when there are only two, yes, two available firefighters on call during the day. Mutual aid must be called for from surrounding communities for routine calls, and most EMS units are in the same shape. As much as they appreciate the very used pickup trucks that Enbridge donates to them, I bet they would appreciate a permanent full-time salary and benefited position more. There is no reason that Enbridge does not fund at least two full-time equivalents for our pipeline community fire departments. To continue to rely on volunteer fire departments to be the first response and rescue in the event of a pipeline rupture is nothing more than socializing the risk for their profit. They know that we have a heart for it, but we do not have the numbers for an adequate response. During a routine pickup truck donation by Enbridge in Waterloo, a rather regular occurrence in any small pipeline town these days, WISE volunteers attempted to attend the ceremony, but we were blocked despite pleas from the city council member to let the public in. WISE simply wanted to present the Waterloo Fire Department with a copy of the report on dilbit from the National Academy of Sciences. Fortunately, one of the city council members accepted our report, but we, the people, were left to stand out in the cold December rain thanks to the Waterloo mayor. It's obvious these pipelines are not your typical crude pipelines. Both of these black lines are tar sands pipelines melting snow. It looks like this in many locations in the line. There are two tar sands pipelines, actually. 6A is as big as the Keystone, almost, 780,000 barrels per day. And then we have the Behemoth Line 61, which is 1.2 million barrels per day. So what can my town, legendary Lake Mills, do besides hope we are not legendary in the way that Mayflower, Arkansas, or Marshall, Michigan is? We have four pipelines, two of them tar sands already in the ground. It's not likely those will go away. Options are limited, but we can be creative. We can question our authorities on their emergency response plans. And we can do what Enbridge should be doing, teaching our pipeline residents what to do in case of a serious breach in the line. Unfortunately, there's no pat answer to that dilemma either. Each resident must make a decision on their own based on a number of criteria. Some will make the right decision in the event of a rupture, and some may not. Some will just make a decision, not right and not wrong, and still have a very bad day. They must know their elevation relative to the pipeline. Heavier than air toxic gas will sink to the lowest level it can. They must know the wind direction. It will be somewhat affected by wind. And to escape, one must get upwind of the breach. Residents must be prepared to make the decision as to whether to flee or shelter in place in a few minutes. They cannot use anything that generates a spark, including a cell phone or a flashlight, lest they ignite volatile fumes, which is a bit of a problem because Enbridge tells you to use your phone. Yes, Enbridge does put out a brochure mentioning some of the points I listed. However, they don't discuss much prior to the first responders getting there to rescue people, and not all their recommendations are applicable to every situation. I just checked, and it's been over a year and a half since they've sent out a brochure. They, too, know clearly that some of the people are too deeply in the sacrifice zone. Brave Wisconsin, our local group, along with WISE, is going to be providing safety packets with wind flags and glow sticks and literature so folks become aware of the factors that they need to consider when deciding to evacuate and when planning how they are going to accomplish this. I can't imagine having to live with a pipeline rupture hanging over one's head all the time. I'm fortunate that I now live east of town, far enough away so that I'm no longer in immediate danger. However, I live on the Crawfish River, which would be impacted by any breach from the Medina pump station all the way down to Lake Mills. My well could likely be impacted, and we would get a whiff of benzene. Still, that's not the same as having to run for my life in the middle of the night, and I can't help but think of my former home and the family that lives there now and my neighbors and friends. Life in a sacrifice zone means that life, your life and your property, is disposable. Sacrificed for the greater good. The Enbridge brochure doesn't say that. The fossil fuel industry knew the danger when they first placed these lines decades ago, when there were fewer people out in the country. And they know it even more now, now that the countryside has filled in with homes that should never have been built along that easement. Apparently, it's an acceptable risk for their corporation. I don't think it's an acceptable risk for the people of my community. It's all risk and no reward. I don't think it's an acceptable risk for anyone in any town anywhere. We can forget that while we're passionate about fighting global climate change, and with good reason, it will be the death of us all. There are other levels of this being played out in small towns all over Wisconsin. People are facing potential financial ruin, displacement, and daily danger on top of the issue of climate change, which incidentally they may or may not believe in. Most of these people do not own easement and have nothing to negotiate with Enbridge. They just happen to live near the easement, and they deserve a voice and someone to fight for them. But others do own the property Enbridge wants, and they are key to fighting this. Landowners on the pipeline are central to this battle, and they have their personal struggles too. So this is Lake Mills, and its people are my community. We are your neighbors just a few miles away, and this makes this fight very personal, as it should for you too. Lake Mills, Marshall, Waterloo, Jefferson, Cambridge, Fort Atkinson, all special places to very ordinary people who live very ordinary lives. which now include very unexpected flashes of future fear countered by moments of political heroism, times of purposeful forgetting and reluctant remembering, and times of denial and defiance, all in rapid succession some days, simply because we now live in a petrochemical sacrifice zone. And as much as we'd like to deny it, it's our reality. I just want to thank you all for listening to my story. It means so much to me to know that all of you care to come out and listen to this. I just really appreciate it. Thank you.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to People vs. Pipelines, a panel discussion and an update on the Enbridge Tar Sands Pipeline expansion, proposed to run through Wisconsin and the northeast corner of Dane County. The speakers are Cassie Stein, Mary Beth Elliott, Ronnie Monroe, and Harry Bennett.
Last is Harry Bennett. In 2008, Harry fought the Keystone Cushing Extension Pipeline next to his farm in Kansas.
Thank you for inviting us to tell our stories. Mine's going to be a little bit different. It's a personal story of one landowner, one farm owner's experience with living next to a pipeline and under construction. This is a view of our farm. It's in Marion County, Kansas. I no longer own it. We purchased it in 1978. I was in my late 20s. My wife and I had two young daughters at the time. We had another one shortly after purchasing it. And it was made up of about 25 acres, a 40-acre farm, 25 acres of cultivated ground cleared, and then it had 15 acres of timber. And for those 30-odd years, it was basically the center of our universe. At one point, we calculated we were about 80% self-sufficient from the things that we grew. All of our fuel came from the woods, and we cared deeply about the riparian area and took care of it as best we could because of the things it provided us. In 2007, we were approached, got a letter from TransCanada informing us that the Keystone Pipeline would be we would be on the easement of this Keystone Pipeline. And we quickly got up to speed on just what Keystone had in mind, the Keystone was going to do. TransCanada transports tar sands from the Alberta, northern Alberta area. And more we learned about it, the worse we thought it was going to be. Little did we know that the term sacrifice zone was applicable to us. We didn't feel like we lived in a sacrifice zone until we did. So Kansas is home, and Marion County, Kansas, where we lived, is a part of the Tallgrass Prairie, the largest existing prairie unbroken in the United States. Now, fortunately, during the summer of 2007-2008, we were able, several neighbors, to convince TransCanada to straighten out the line and avoid going through two small holdings, and they went right to the south of our line. So rather than being easement holders, we were just going to live approximately about 100 yards off of my property line. This is a map of where it goes from Alberta down to the Gulf. But the line that we were concerned with, that is called the Keystone Cushing Extension, which later was designated as the Keystone XL. And it goes to Cushing, Oklahoma, 36 inches, and was built to capacity, 1,700 PSI, pounds per square inch, would flow approximately 450,000 barrels of oil, crude oil, tar sands oil, per day. This is the road that was right adjacent to our house, and this was kind of the startup of things in the summer of 2010, 26-foot-wide rural road. And this was a view of the constant traffic that we had for approximately 4 months during the construction period. I spoke about the riparian area, and that's my deer stand up there in a large tree that was adjacent to the creek that I own both sides of. And one of the requirements of when you're in the easement, there will never be allowed to have trees planted again in the easement holding, which is 50 foot wide in the case of this one. I believe it's 80 foot wide here in Wisconsin. Of course, trees have to come down when you build an oil pipeline. This is the creek, Spring Branch Creek, which, as I said, we own both sides of, and about a quarter mile of it ran through our land. This is a bridge, a temporary construction bridge that was built over the creek to facilitate the movement of the track hose and the things they would have to do to trench through the creek. And this was one of the points of contention that I had with the pipeline company that I started in lobbying for a boring. I wanted them to bore under the creek and be able to preserve the riparian area. They were not required to do that, nor did they have any desire to do that because of the increased expense. So they use what they call the wet trench method. And the wet trench method is essentially you dig through the banks on either side and under the creek bed itself and lay the pipe 5 foot below the bottom of the creek bed. And they built this bridge. Now, the bridge is constructed of what they call construction mats. And these are basically, those are individual units that are about 5 to 6 foot wide, 14 foot long, and a foot thick. Now, this bridge, I'd lived next to that creek at that point almost 30 years and farmed it, and I had seen high water incidences. And so I decided that I would try to get a meeting together to maybe give them a little information about it. And so I was able to get a representative of the Corps of Engineers, a representative from PHMSA, the construction company, and TransCanada had their environmental engineer or something. So anyway, they all came to my house, and I told them, you haven't seen that creek when you get a 5-inch rain and the repercussions that are going to happen. And they told me that they were engineers and that they knew about what was going to happen and they could see through it. Well, we started getting our spring rains and they got higher and higher. And then the bridge was gone. Now, those engineers had failed to tie those things and secure them adequately. And so they went everywhere, fair amount of erosion to the riparian area. Now, while I could not get them to bore under the creek, this was the Union Pacific rail line that ran right adjacent to my property that they had to go, the pipeline had to go across. They dug a trench on either side 20 foot deep and bored under the railroad track so that there would never, ever be an interruption to rail traffic during the construction of that pipeline. So there is a little difference in the power structure of quite a muddy occurrence. And, of course, we were having quite a bit of rain in those times. But everything in Kansas, it eventually dries up, and it really dries up. And here we are. They've got the pipe laid on the ground with the welds made, and it's ready to put in the trench. Of course, at the same time, they're doing a process called dewatering. And this was not a natural occurring creek. This is the result of the dewatering activities that the pipeline construction company did every day. There was no easement agreement with me. And later on, when I started pressing the issue with their attorney, they eventually, I think, gave me $2,000 as a reward for going away. So here's the trench where they were going to bore and go under the railroad track. Now, we've had a month or more of dry weather. Every night, this trench would fill up. That is not rainwater. That is not drain water. That's my water from my alluvial water table that comes up. The static level in my wells came up to 15 feet. They're at approximately 20, 25 feet there deep. So the groundwater was coming up every night into that trench where they were going to bore and lay the pipe. Now, if you look in the middle of that trench where they're going to put the pipe in and weld it, this is the bored pipe that they came out of the hole with. That's the pipe. and that's my water. That's the water that I had two wells that I depended on for all the water use on our farm, irrigation for my orchard, the water for my animals, and the water for our household that my three daughters and my wife and I depended on for our water use. This was disconcerting. And when I brought this up to, you know, whoever I could, and I was attempting to talk to anyone, PHMSA, the Pipeline Hazardous Material Safety Administration, a part of the Department of Transportation, the federal watchdog, the Corps of Engineers, who supposedly are the guardians of our water resource, and then the Kansas Department of Health and Environment, I got deaf ears, you know, no concerns at all, just go away. It was basically the advice I got. Now, this is a little postscript. After the pipeline had been completed, and this was, they went away in October, and they started doing the hydrostatic testing that would pressurize the pipeline and get it ready, you know, get it passed on its testing for being to get the product in it. Apparently, something was not right near where they had gone under the railroad track. So in November of that 2010, a fleet of trucks came back and equipment and mats and everything, and they quickly excavated the pipeline, dug it up, exposed it, cut out a chunk, welded in a new piece, and then went away. I had made contacts with a PHMSA representative in the Kansas City office, who is the same region that has oversight of Wisconsin pipeline issues, and I was stonewalled. And it was such a onerous task to go through their FOIA request to find out what the heck had gone wrong with this. And to this day, I've never been told what exactly went bad. Obviously, the wells were not what they should have been. And this is a critical spot in pipeline construction because it goes through almost a 90-degree bend as it goes under the railroad tracks. It straightens out on one side, goes under the railroad track, then comes around and bends again. Those are going to be the most critical places in this highly volatile, high-pressurized, poisoned substance that they're sending through the countryside for, they say, the next 100 years. I got involved with Sierra Club toward the end of this, before I sold the farm, and this was a part of a campaign booklet that they put out that was probably one of the first national movements to energize people to the, you know, this was right around the same time as the Kalamazoo, because prior to all of that, the public was generally in the dark about what tar sands was about, these large pipelines. And so under the kind of the veil of bad economic times and everything in the country, and we were Middle Eastern wars, tar sands just got a pass. Well, that time is over for the industry. So I would leave you as an individual that fought this. You can't give up. Like I said, my full-time job now is I'm a grandpa. I've got four grandchildren, range from 1.5 years old to 6. And I sure as hell do not want them confronting me in 20 years when this thing really has its full exposure of just what we've got afoot here. And they ask me, what in the hell were you thinking about or doing? I want to be able to at least maybe bring this up and say, well, I tried. So thank you.
You've been listening to People versus Pipelines, a panel discussion and an update on the Enbridge Tar Sands Pipeline expansion that is proposed to run through Wisconsin, including the northeast corner of Dane County. This talk took place on June 9, 2016, on the UW-Madison campus and was sponsored by 350 Madison, the Madison Institute, the group WISE, and the Sierra Club. For more information about the Tar Sands Pipeline expansion, go to 350 Madison's website at 350madison.org.